You are listening to a podcast from The National.
Welcome to another episode of the Extra Time podcast. I'm your host this week, Steve Luckins. Joining me today to discuss the draw for the FIFA Club World Cup is John McCauley. John, how are you, mate?
I'm very well, thanks, Steve. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad, mate. Not too bad. So you've just come back from the draw at the Fairmont Bab El Baha Hotel in Abu Dhabi. Al Jazeera looked like they could be drawn alongside Real Madrid in the semi-finals, obviously depending on them negotiating their playoff against, is it Auckland City?
Yep, they've got Auckland City on the 6th of December, which is the first match to kick everything off. The tournament runs until the 16th of December. They play Auckland City, who are the Oceania champions. If they get through that, they then play the winners of the Asian Champions League. And then, if they were to get through that, a lot of ifs and buts, if they get through that, they will play Real Madrid.
So the winner of the Asian Champions League, potentially we could be looking at Al Hilal of Saudi Arabia, which would obviously be another fixture the organisers would be crossing their fingers for.
Oh, definitely. And the LOC, the LOC committee there, they said exactly the same thing. Or else they were saying as well that they could maybe have Shanghai there. And they would imagine that they would bring quite a lot of fans as well. But the plum draw for the UAE would definitely be Jazeera against Al Hilal. Hilal look as if they'll get to the final. They're 4-0 up over Persepolis. And they've got to play the return leg next week. So they look as if they will be there.
A game that was played at Al Jazeera Stadium, the first leg.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So it's come full circle. But it would be fantastic because Hilal always bring, anytime they play here in the Asian Champions League, they always bring huge support with them. They've got a lot of fans inside the UAE as well as obviously from Saudi Arabia. So as I said, that would be a real marquee match. But Jazeera need to get through the first match against Auckland City.
Oh, definitely. But you know, you talk about Al Hilal and we're talking about Al Jazeera, but no doubt the big draw obviously is Real Madrid. Now tell us, are there actually any tickets left for any of Real Madrid's matches?
Well, that was the interesting thing. Speaking to the local organising committee again, they said that all of the, basically they've released tickets for the semi-final and final, which they would imagine Real Madrid will be in, unless they come up against Al Jazeera, obviously.
I think it's a pretty safe bet, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So they said that they've released the first batch, which was about 70%, if I'm not mistaken, of tickets, and they're going to release another 30% sometime in the coming weeks. But they're, ever since I've been speaking to them, since the summer, really, they've been hammering home that they really want fans to go out and get tickets as soon as possible, because obviously Real Madrid, everyone wants to be there to see them in action.
And just remind us, John, the two venues where the games will be taking place.
Yeah, so Zayed Sports City here in Abu Dhabi, and then the other one's Hazza bin Zayed Stadium in Al Ain, which is, for me, it's one of the best stadiums in the region, probably.
Yeah, most definitely. Now, there are a couple of FIFA legends down there today. Eric Abidal, Mikel Silvest, and Ivan Cordoba. Cordoba and Abidal would have played in previous editions here in Abu Dhabi in 2009 and 2010.
Yeah.
God, that's good knowledge, isn't it? Any decent tidbits from any of them players? Any interesting conversations thrown up?
Well, Abidal, we had a round table with him, and he spoke quite well on the Barcelona team of 2009, and obviously they won the sixth, whenever they won in Abu Dhabi, they won their sixth title of the year, and it was, I think, they made history, the first team to do that in a calendar year.
And who was the first player to score in six tournaments that
Pedro.
Year?
Pedro.
Pedro.
I've done my research as well, thankfully, for once. So he spoke about that, saying that team, obviously many people consider that to be one of the greatest club teams ever, and he spoke quite gushingly about how good that team was, and they had Pep Guardiola at its head, and he said that just Guardiola, just every single detail mattered to him. And he said you can have the best players in the world, you can have the best generation of players or the best squad that maybe in history, but he said that you need a manager to put that together and ensure that they create history, which they did do.
And did any other modern day players come up in conversation? I imagine there's at least a fellow Frenchman who's quite high in his praise at the moment.
Yeah. Abidal spoke about Kylian Mbappe. One of the guys put the question to him that Arsene Wenger had said recently that Mbappe could be as good as Pele, which is quite a big call. And Abidal said...
No pressure there, then.
Exactly, for an 18-year-old. But Abidal said, look, he said Mbappe's got all the talent in the world. He's totally believes that he'll be kind of top echelon of elite footballers very, very soon in the next couple of years. But he said that what he has to do, he says he has to work hard. He says the talent is nowhere near enough. And he said that he believes that he does have the right mentality to do that. And he said as well, speaking as a Frenchman, he says it's not just kind of club football that he'd take an interest in. He says for the national team, he could be a big player for the future.
Awesome stuff. Well, that's all we've got time for from John, who's off and leaving us already today. I'm also joined in the studio today by our sports editor, Graham Cagle. Graham, how are you, my friend?
Very good, thanks, Steve.
Jolly good. We've got on the agenda today qualifying for the World Cup in 2018. We're faced with a very real prospect of no Lionel Messi and no Argentina in Russia next year. Also, the Netherlands look almost certain to miss out, especially after Dick Advocaat's now infamous remarks about Sweden not beating Luxembourg 8-0. Even Cristiano Ronaldo's Portugal was still by no means certain to avoid the treacherous route of a playoff. And then we've got Syria's fairy tale run in the playoffs where they face Australia. So let's dive straight into it. Argentina, sixth in South American qualifying, outside even a playoff place, and they face an Ecuador side managed by another Argentine, Jorge Silicio, in a game they absolutely have to win on Tuesday night.
It's a crazy scenario when you think about it, with the talent they've got at their disposal, that they're in this situation. And as you said, it's even harder to imagine we're in a situation where there could be no Messi and also possibly no Ronaldo at the World Cup next year, which we obviously get very excited about the World Cup whenever it comes around, this expectation it's the best players in the test. And now we know that not always the case, because in the 1990s, when Ryan Giggs was one of the greatest players in Europe at the very least, he never played in the World Cup. But we've seen Messi there, and obviously Messi's got this huge pressure on him, and like, you know, can he follow Maradona's footsteps and win a World Cup with Argentina, something that's been put on him even though he's won all these trophies with Barcelona. And he's not going to be getting any younger. This might well be his last chance.
Well, this is it. Both Messi and Ronaldo, you would think realistically this is both their World Cup.
Oh no, absolutely. I mean, you've got to think, well, with Portugal, it's kind of odd they're in this situation that they're in now, when, you know, they're the European champions. But they kind of proved at the Euros that they could do it without Ronaldo when they actually won the tournament when he got injured in the final. But I'm more, obviously, I'm much more confident about Portugal, because in the playoffs, I think that's how they got to the previous World Cup. They did it that way. So I don't think they've got anything to be scared of.
But isn't it an anomaly? Switzerland, like when you consider someone like England, who really failed to inspire, there's a real disconnect between them and their fans for the brand of football they play, qualified with a game to spare. Switzerland have won 9 games on the trot, and yet still aren't even assured of going through automatically. If their final game is against Portugal, if Portugal win that game, they will go through automatically. It's bizarre the way some of these groups have worked out.
I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Steve. I think it is, might have to have a look at how they reseed things, because you look at England's group, and saying this is a half Scotsman, the fact that Scotland got as close as they could, and you think that the fact that Netherlands almost certainly aren't going, Portugal might not, teams like Argentina from South America might not go. It does seem, I think there's definitely ways they can sort of revamp this, because we seem to go through a lot of time and pain and energy, because you can almost see people's shoulders slump and they realise it's international weekend again. And you have to wait 2 years to get to this period of, oh, someone might miss out. And some groups, as you said, have been very competitive, but there are others that haven't been. And as I said, it is kind of odd when you think of how poor England have been, at particularly at major tournaments, that they've absolutely swanned through their group as comfortably as they have.
And just to go back to the South American group, Gray. So like we said, Argentina in sixth place. Peru face Colombia in Lima. Peru are fifth. They hold the playoff spot, should it finish like that. And then we've got Paraguay, who've also got a chance of qualifying against bottom side Venezuela. Now, it's been a terrible qualifying campaign by Lionel Messi and co. Now, when you consider, or when you look across Europe's top leagues, Lionel Messi doing it in Spain, Sergio Aguero doing it in England, Paulo Dybala and Gonzalo Higuain doing it in Italy, and yet they're in a situation where they actually need results to go their way just to book their ticket to Russia 2018. What's happened to them?
An interesting sort of aside, just really sort of picking up what you've just been saying there, is because they also play in different leagues and play a part, it almost feels like they might well be strangers to each other. Yeah, they might probably knew each other when they're coming up through youth sides and such. But as you said, having watched one of the most recent games when they failed to score again, you're kind of just looking at them thinking they were playing like a set of individuals.
Yeah, it's three consecutive draws, isn't it? A defeat before that and a win before that. It's just been so the campaign has just failed to fire at any stage. Started off with a 2-0 defeat to Ecuador.
And Messi's not the only class player to suffer from this scenario where he has a great club side that he plays alongside and he goes off to play international football and he's playing probably with worse players. He's playing in a weaker side and it probably does. We've always had that argument, could Messi do it on a Tuesday night in Stoke? Well, right. Can he do it on a Tuesday night?
You've only got to look at the England team for that argument, yeah. Really, haven't you? But okay, then so moving on. Like we said, we've touched on the Netherlands and Dick Advocaat's now almost infamous flippant remark that Sweden wouldn't beat Luxembourg 8-0. What a stupid question. And of course, Sweden went out and beat Luxembourg 8-0 with a hat-trick by our very own Alain striker, Marcus Borg, in that game. Four goals, sorry. Colts managed to get that one off to me before he shut off. It always seems a shame, Gray, when traditional powerhouses like the Netherlands fail to qualify for major events. And in their case, two major events since they missed out on Euro 2016. I think in their case, you look at their squad and, you know, we're a great fan of Sporkle, aren't we? And one of the quizzes on there is name all the starting 11s of the Dutch sides going back to 1994. And you could pretty much do it. I don't think you can with this current team. You know, the likes of Robin van Persie, the Schneiders, Van der Vaarts, Cocu, there's no real standout players in that Dutch squad anymore. That, you know, that everyone can reel off 1 to 11.
No, I think you're completely right. They've been through this amazing period of having a conveyor belt of bringing talent through. And you think of just how good that, in fairness, probably their last really great moment was that 5-1 win over Spain at the start of World Cup 2014, when we thought, wow, this is like, you know, they really are the real deal. When it turns out, it's probably more to do with Spain really falling off the cliff at that tournament rather than the other way around.
Because I thought they were very average after that game.
No, man. I still remember the horror of that quarterfinal with Costa Rica and sort of, I think, Manchester United fans beginning to realise what they've just got themselves into after yeah. Moyes with Van Gaal. I think the only hope for the Dutch is, I think every country does go through a little blip where talent's not always coming through and they might have more talent coming from the future. But I think sometimes it's learning from your mistakes and stuff. So the Dutch normally have been quite good at learning from that in the past. And I think if you had to look at someone for a bit of inspiration, you have to maybe look at France, who I don't think they qualified for World Cup 1990 or 1994, but bounced back very strongly and won World Cup 98. I'm not saying, you know, watch out for the Dutch and Qatar in 2022, but I think obviously traditionally with the players they bring through, they're too good not to be going to World Cups. And there's something is deeply wrong. They've been changing coach repeatedly and such. But hopefully they can just take this as sort of a lesson to sort of like pick on and sort of maybe for Euro 2020 come back stronger.
Okay, moving on from Europe into Asia qualifying. The undoubted success story of this campaign has been Syria. Unable to play matches at home given the 6-year civil war that has ravaged the country. But they can write another chapter in their fairy tale story if they can overcome Australia in Sydney in their second leg playoff on Tuesday. They've got some serious talent up front. I think one of our esteemed sports reporters wrote a comment piece last week focusing on Omar Al Soma, who actually scored the pretty controversial penalty in the first leg that finished 1-1 in Malaysia. But you sense that Australia maybe have left a little bit back in that game and will bring out the big guns. Players like Tim Cahill didn't play in that match. Tom Rogic saw very few minutes on the pitch in that game. I think he definitely held enough back. He didn't play his full hand in that game, the Australian manager.
No, I agree. I think it'll be very interesting to see sort of how Syria start that match, because I think they're going to expect a barrage, because the one thing Australia have got is a lot of Western experience in their sides. And sort of, I remember both times they played the UAE, when they played them in the World Cup qualifying recently, they exploited UAE's inexperience at the back. And now the one thing Syria have really kind of got this far on the back of is having a strong defence. But I think it will be tested. Not sure if Tim Cahill will start the game or not, or they will bring him on. But the aerial threat and challenge that they will be under at set pieces particularly will be huge. I'm like you, I've kind of got a feeling Australia kind of have left a little bit in the tank. And I think it might come a little bit more down to just big match experience. I think it's been a fantastic achievement, considering everything that's been going on in Syria, the fact that the team have got this far. But I do think this probably is going to be a step too far, and I think we're going to be looking at Australia going on into the final playoff match.
Yeah, as you say, this is a precursor to the final playoff match. The winner of this game will play the fourth place team in the CONCACAF region, which is currently Panama. I know you know your football, Gray, but I'm guessing you don't know much about Panamanian footballers, so we'll leave that one there. Let's move on to the Premier League, which, of course, resumes this weekend. Undoubtedly, the most tantalising fixture on the list is Liverpool taking on Manchester United at Anfield. And it's Jose Mourinho's first real test this season. They had a very, very favourable fixtures list going into both international breaks. So it's going to be a real test of their credentials and where they're really at coming up against one of the top teams.
I think it's going to be very, very interesting how they approach it, because they've got a lot of injury problems at the moment. Obviously, Pogba's got a spell out and Fellaini's gone down and is pretty much ruled out, I think, for the rest of October. So everything I kind of know about Mourinho, and we've learned from watching him over the past, I've got a feeling he's going to try and sit back against Liverpool. He'll probably take a point. Knowing everything we know about him from previous times, he'll settle for a point, maybe try and hit him on the counter-attack.
And hopefully, since when has a point at Anfield been a bad result?
No, completely. It's going to be interesting if Manchester United fans can get used to it, because obviously they've been used to years of Sir Alex Ferguson sort of swashbuckling, counter-attacking wins and, you know, exciting play. And there's no reason why they can't do that if they play with Martial and Rashford up front, or sort of bring them off the bench. Because I think it's a huge game for Liverpool as well, because they've just come off the back of a very ordinary September. And the first real signs of Klopp beginning to crack, I felt like, some of his comments after the Newcastle game, like, he was really having a big old moan for the first time. And I think in the past he's hidden it behind humour and sort of like a bit of a laissez-faire attitude, but he was really angry after that Newcastle game. And he was just moaning about the fact that they had about 15 shots on goal to Newcastle's one and drew 1-0, not understanding that's the beauty of football. You don't get bonus points for shots in there.
I agree. I guess the other fixture to look out for on that would be poor old Crystal Palace, winless, pointless, goalless, fresh in their two most recent games by Manchester City United. And it's not getting any easier with them with the visit of the champions Chelsea.
No, complete. And a Chelsea side will have a point to prove as well, having been so comprehensively beaten by City before the break. The only slight bonus they've got is that there almost certainly will be no Morata on the pitch in that game. But
there'll be no Benteke either for Palace. So yeah.
No, and there's still no Zaha and such. So I think from Roy Hodgson's point of view, just get this game out of the way and then effectively the season starts as a 30-match season and just like see if they can get the 40 points from there. But it's going to be very, very difficult for them, for morale and for belief, trying to bounce back from here. But I think that's all they can do is try and take it game by game after that.
What do you think is the most important thing for Roy Hodgson's team at the moment? To actually score that elusive first goal, or to stop getting hammered 4-5-0 by the top sides?
I think the best example I can think back to is, I don't know if you remember when Terry Venables came in as the problem solver at Middlesbrough in 2000, when Brian Robson looked like a man who just run out of ideas. Venables always said the first rule of, yeah, we're not scoring, but if you stop conceding, at least you're getting a point. That's something to build on. So I think that's what they've got to do, because I remember watching the Southampton game last month and there was nothing in it, but they were just making silly little mistakes at the back. And if you cut those out, then at the very least, points, at this point they need wins desperately, but they also need some points in any shape or form. So if you can sort yourself out the back to at least start off with, that's at least something. And obviously with no Benteke and no Zaha, that might be the easier problem to solve.
Definitely, definitely. Okay, well, that's all we've got time for this week. Thanks very much for joining us, Gray.
Cheers, Steve.
You can subscribe to the Extra Time podcast on iTunes or find us on the website at thenational.ae/sport. Thanks for listening.